we're drawing to that kind of big transition within the gospel according to Matthew. We've just covered the largest portion of Jesus' instruction, what he teaches us in the Sermon on the Mount, the longest single collection of instruction that we have from Jesus. And we're shifting now from what we call red-letter words to black-letter words, from the words of Jesus to his actions here, beginning in chapter 8. It's going to be in your pew Bible, page 1507. It's said that sometimes actions speak louder than words. And at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, it says that the crowds who had heard Jesus were astonished by Jesus. And my prayer is that as you have heard Jesus speak, that you will now see what he does. And seeing Jesus, my prayer is that you too will be astonished by him. That he won't just be a cognitive belief, a philosophy, a system of propositions in your head that you believe are propositionally true and an accurate picture of reality, but that he will be something that moves your heart, that the thought of Christ will so move you that it will leave you at times in joy and at other times in tears. My prayer is that you would meet Jesus. It's been said, to borrow the words of Randy Newman, that we Christians might not always have an airtight argument or an airtight proof, but maybe we have an airtight person in Jesus. Some of you are pretty jaded. You've had bad experiences in church. Some of you can't believe you're in a church this morning. Some of you, maybe you're Christians. Maybe you believe, but you're so scarred and you have such low expectations of what actually happens when you open the pages of your Bible or when you sit in the pew with a room full of Christians. You just sit there and nothing seems to happen. You're dry as dust inside. God seems to be characterized not by closeness to you, but by distance from you. My prayer is that you will see the face of God this morning, and that as we go through and see the acts of Jesus of Nazareth, that he will manifest himself supernaturally in your presence this morning as you hear from him, that you will savor him, that you will see the beauty of Jesus, that you will see not the splendor and greatness of the church, but the splendor and greatness of the Son of God, so that we can pull back the veil and say, can you see this? Can you see who this is? I want to see Jesus. We're about to look at these records of his first miracles. If you would turn in your Bible to Matthew 8, page 1507 in the Pew Bible, we're going to ask three questions. We're going to ask as we look at these first healings of Jesus. We're going to ask who he healed. We're going to ask why he healed them. And at what cost he did so. Matthew chapter 8, beginning in verse 1. This is the word of the Lord. When he, that is Jesus, when Jesus came down from the mountainside, large crowds followed him. A man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. And Jesus reached out his hand and he touched the man. I am willing, he said, be clean. Immediately the man was cured of his leprosy, and then Jesus said to him, see that you don't tell anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them. And when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion, that's a Roman soldier, came to him asking for help. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed and in terrible suffering. Jesus said to him, I'll go and heal him. The centurion replied, Lord, I don't deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. I tell that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. And when Jesus heard this, he was astonished. And said to those following him, I tell you the truth, I've not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. I say to you that many will come from the east and from the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then Jesus said to the centurion, "Go, it will be done just as you believed it would." And his servant was healed at that very hour. When Jesus came into Peter's house, he saw Peter's mother-in-law lying in a bed with a fever. And he touched her hand, and the fever left her. And she got up and began to wait on him. And then when evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with a word and healed all the sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and carried our diseases. Who did he heal? Why? At what cost? Who did Jesus heal? It's just in this chapter so far, it's an incredibly inclusive group of people, but the first recorded healing that we have here is of a leper. Now, in the first century, we think, of course, today of leprosy, and we think of what's properly called Hansen's disease. It's where the nerve endings in your fingertips and your toes and your nose and your ears, you lose feeling in them, and there can be accidents and injuries, and you don't know that you're injured, and so you can lose them, and it leaves you horribly disfigured. But in the ancient world, leprosy was a word that was used to describe a whole host of skin diseases, infectious diseases of the skin, the kind of thing which, you know, even into the modern era would send someone into quarantine. And a leper in Israel in the first century was the ultimate social outcast. Lepers were believed, not in the Bible, but they were believed in the first century to be outcasts because they had been rejected by God. A leper, it was believed, was a leper because of some unconfessed sin that they have not named. You look in the Talmud and the Mishnah and the Jewish writings, the rabbis who wrote in the centuries around Jesus, and they say that leprosy is a curse of God for libel. It's the curse that God gives people when they've had an incestuous relationship with someone in their family. That a leper is a leper because they've made vain oaths, they've robbed people, they are murderers, they are filled with envy. To be a leper meant that you were obviously guilty. Your family name was dirt. Your honor was gone. You were objects of shame and scorn and ridicule. God did not smile upon you. God did not bless you. God cursed you. God did not turn his face toward you. He turned his face away from you because God was disgusted with you. And so he struck you down with this horrible disease. And it was a disease that would not just leave you physically scarred and injured. It would leave you unclean. And therefore, under Jewish law, you could not be touched. You had to live outside the walls, outside of the city, outside of the towns, alone in the countryside where you could not infect anyone else with your filth. You had to live expelled from community. If you can imagine the loss when you wake up in that morning and you've got this white and red blotch going up your arm and your husband, your wife turns away from you in utter horror and shame and they look at you perhaps for the last time as you are then forced by the community, perhaps being stoned on your way out of your village, out of your home, never to see again your husband or your wife, never again to feel the touch of a lover, to feel the touch of a friend, to feel the embrace, the hug, the kiss of someone who loves you, to lose your career because you could no longer function within the town. If you can imagine socially what it did to you to be cursed with this disease, in the Talmud, you are forbidden to walk within 4 feet or 4 cubits of a leper. That means if there's a leper in the room, you have to stay at least 6 feet away from him at all costs. If there was wind, you had to stay 100 cubits away from a leper. There's always wind, 150 feet away, according to the Talmud. That means if there's a leper in the golf course in Forest Park walking toward the sidewalk, we all have to get up and go out that door that way in order to remain pure and clean ourselves and not fall under the same judgment. The rabbi Resh Lakish, about this time, it was written that when he saw a leper, he would cast stones at him and say, "Get back to your location and stop contaminating other people." To lose your health, your friends, your home, if you can imagine the wooden spoon with which you stir the flour every day in your kitchen, to never see or touch that spoon again, to never again make food for your family, to never again sit down at the table with your family, to lose everything. This leper comes up to Jesus and kneels before him, perhaps 10, 15 feet away, and you can just picture the crowd parting like the Red Sea. They were going to stay at least 6 feet, 4 cubits away from him or be unclean themselves. And yet, Jesus sees him. And Jesus does the most extreme, irreligious, forbidden, godless, antisocial, hateful, undermining, subversive, civilization-collapsing action he could possibly have done in the eyes of the people. They expected him to pick up stones, to throw stones and say, "Get away, you're going to contaminate all these people." And instead, Jesus, this leper, he says, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." And Jesus walks up to him, and Jesus touches him. You can hear all of the oxygen being sucked out of the room. There is no more air on the mountain anymore, because you can hear from the people the as everybody recoils backward, as their eyes become huge, as they watch this rabbi who has amazed them with his teaching. And they expect to see the creeping stain going up his arms. They expect to see him turn white as a sheet. They expect to see the blisters popping up all over him. But instead, the wave goes the other way. The filth does not come into Jesus, it appears, but rather the cleanness washes from Jesus over the leper. And they watch as his skin becomes clean. And Jesus has just given him back his spouse, his children, his parents, his school, his career, his worship in the synagogue, his honor, his family name has been restored. In the eyes of the community, this one is now righteous because there is no more judgment upon his skin. This is the ultimate social outcast, and Jesus has healed him. And then Jesus goes to a Gentile commander, a Roman centurion. This is, if you can imagine, if this is Belgium in the First World War, Belgium circa 1916, and we're a bunch of Belgians, and we're all hanging out eating waffles and fries or whatever Belgian people do, chocolates, Hercule Poirot with his, you know, hipster mustaches behind us, you know, serving a cravat of something, I don't know. And then in walks Jesus. And you're like, "That's Jesus." And then in walks the local German general. And Jesus goes up to him and he says, "I have a miracle for you." And they're like, "Jesus, sit down and have some waffles. We need to talk to you. You're not supposed to do this. You don't heal the servant of the invading general, Jesus." This guy would have been despised, cursed in the synagogues, despised by the religious, distrusted by the irreligious. This was the person who, next to the leper, would have been the second most despised person in ancient Israel. He's a social outcast. And Jesus heals his servant, and then a woman. Peter's mother-in-law. Not just a woman, but a mother-in-law. Jesus heals her too. Women were considered, you know, the lowest of people, the dregs of society. It was the half of the population that didn't count, didn't matter in the first century. Under Jewish law, a woman's value was half that of a man. In ancient Judaism, you got pregnant, you had a little girl. People mourned with you because you wanted a son, because sons were valuable. Sons carried on the family wealth, the family honor, the family name. Daughters, you had to marry off and send a dowry. It wasn't the same. A woman couldn't testify in a court of law if she witnessed a murder and she said, "I saw it," to women. "Hey, we saw this happen." They're like, "You're women. You don't count.
And Jesus heals a woman. And then people afflicted by unclean spirits. We're talking the lowest of the low. Right there with the lepers. These people, everybody Jesus heals here is a social outcast. Just look at the diversity of the kingdom. When Jesus says that there are people who are going to come from the east and from the west and take their places with Abraham in the new earth, at the resurrection, at the kingdom of God, he's saying from a Roman-Palestinian perspective, there are going to be Iranians there. There are going to be Spaniards there. There are going to be all sorts of people from Parthia and from España, from the east and west of the empire, from all over the world. These are not the people that we would pick for our team. You know, were I to decide who I was going to heal, in all honesty, if I weren't walking with Jesus, I would want to heal, the Sultan of Brunei's little boy, because that would set me up. He's one of the richest men on earth. That would set me up real good for a long time. I would want to heal the rich and the powerful, people who would then owe me favors. I would want to heal the emperor. I would want to heal the senators. I would want to heal the chief priest. I would want to heal the richest, most hog-wealthy people. Doesn't matter if they're mafia in the first century Palestine. Those are the folks that I would heal. Because those are the cultural insiders. They could repay me. They would owe me one, and they would have the ability to get things done, the movers and the shakers, and that's who we gravitate toward. The powerful, the wealthy, the influential, and Jesus gravitates toward the weak, toward the poor, toward the dispossessed, towards the overlooked. Who does he heal? He heals the losers in the eyes of the world. It's like when I was in elementary school, we had this, it was the worst day of the year. It was the day that I dreaded. If I could use the radiator to get my temperature up in the morning, if I could fake a cough, I would do it this day. It was the day of death. They called it field day. And on field day, you went outside and did sports the whole time. And that always involved, because we wanted to get the kids collaborating and building teamwork, that meant you took cruel children and let them pick teams based upon their value system. And they called me Twig, because I was very short, shortest kid, second shortest kid. Darren Scott was shorter, and I was glad for that. That made me look good. And I was really, really skinny, and I was completely uncoordinated, no hand-eye coordination. And so, you know, it came time to pick kickball teams. You know, we'll pick you. Who do you think was the second last every single time right before Darren Scott? Greg Johnson. That's who Jesus picks for his kickball team. He's going to pick the kid who is morbidly obese and can't do anything about it. He is going to pick the kid who has the disability. He's going to pick the kid that nobody likes, that everybody picks on. He's going to pick the little guy and maybe a couple athletic types too, just for diversity's sake. Because that's who Jesus is. He is drawn towards the outcast, toward the beaten up and the knocked down and the bruised and the broken. If you were being asked to plant the church, and you could pick any 10 people in this room to go with you with your new church plant, what are the 10 you would pick? You would pick the wealthiest, because they could fund it. You would pick the most popular extroverts, because they're going to bring their friends and get all sorts of people coming around you. You're going to pick the really gifted people, the people who have lots of free time, the people who are the most committed. And that's not who Jesus picks. He picks a leper. And these are all people who know they're not well. The leper says, "Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean." You didn't have to tell him that he was sick. Jesus said, "I didn't come to heal the sick, but to heal the well, but to call the sick to myself." You think you're well. You think you're strong. You think you got it together. You think, "Hey, I'm gifted, and I'm good looking, and I'm well off, and I got a great job, and I got my life together, and I have this ordered, healthy, self-sufficient life." This is the warning of Jesus. He says, "That's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the sinful and the shameful and the beaten up and the beaten down and the sick and the unwell, and those are the people I am going to heal, because," he says, "I am willing." If Jesus were to come to St. Louis, say, February 2016, Jesus is coming to St. Louis, 3-day whirlwind tour. Okay, he's got a healing ministry. Who's he going to heal? Okay, well,
you know, obviously the way we would go about it is we would have to set up some sort of process to vet candidates. Maybe we'd require that you have to be nominated for healing by three citizens, and you can't fill out your own nomination. You have to fill out an application in advance and then answer some questions, and we'd have a committee that would carefully vet you to see who is the most deserving of healing by Jesus, and none of these people would have made the cut. None of them would have been chosen. They wouldn't have even been nominated. They were outcasts, outsiders, nobodies. You know, we think they're a worthy poor. Jesus doesn't see it that way. They're just poor, broken, bruised sinners like all of us, and some of us are rich and some of us are poor and some of us have great jobs and some of us are unemployed, but it's just a whole bunch of sinners, whole bunch of needy people, whole bunch of losers. That's what Jesus builds his church with. It's the story of C.S. Lewis, theologian, you know, literature scholar, English. C.S. Lewis was walking with a friend across campus one day, and a beggar, you know, a guy stinks, he's got, you know, filthy clothes, dirt under his nails, stains, as obviously he's never had a shower in his life probably, but this beggar comes up and he asks for money, and the friend just turns around and just keeps walking away from the guy, and C.S. Lewis, he actually stops and talks to the guy and opens up his wallet and grabs all of the cash he has and hands it to this stinking beggar. And walks up to his friend, and afterwards his friend is like, "What are you thinking? You know this guy's a bum. You know he's probably going to take that money and he's going to use it to buy booze." And Lewis says, "Well, that's what I was going to spend it on." And we somehow think C.S. Lewis deserves that because he's worthy. There's nothing like an honest theologian, you know, you have to admit. Herman Melville, Moby Dick, said, "Heaven have mercy on us all, Presbyterians and pagans alike, for we're all somehow dreadfully cracked about the head and sadly in need of mending." And yet, every life in chapter 8 that intersects with Jesus, every life that intersects with Jesus gets healed. I look out at all of you, and I don't know all your stories, but I know a whole lot. And I see a whole bunch of people who have been healed by Jesus. Not completely healed, not fully healed. I mean, let's face it, even this leper, even this centurion went on to die eventually. Jesus' healing is a two-stage process. It starts in this life, and then you die, and then you get it back at the resurrection when everything is made right. And yet, what I see here in you are some incredibly diverse stories of brokenness and bondage. Maybe it's you, maybe it's your kids, maybe it's addictive behavior, maybe it's that temper that you've been trying to get a hold of, that string of broken relationships. I see in you people who have experienced the healing hand of Jesus. He has reached out to you, and he has touched you, and he has said, "I am willing, be well." Every life that intersects with Jesus, 2,000 years ago and today, sees some power of healing in their life. Why does he heal? Is he just showing off? Why does he do it? Is it like a Gnostic gospel where he's there to show his power, so that you see in some of these false Gnostic gospels that the media always loves to write stuff about where they're written 400 years later? You see little infant toddler Jesus walking up, and there's a guy who makes fun of him, and he just pulls out his hands and zaps him with a death ray, and the guy goes up in flames. That's showing off. Really, in the Bible, the actual historical ones that are attested by multiple sources, what do we see? Why is he doing this? Nothing like that. He's not just showing off. He's doing two things at least. Notice how he heals. Except in the instance of the leper where he touches, in the other cases, and in the mother as well, but what heals is Jesus speaks. The centurion even makes a point of this. He says, "Now, you don't need to come to my house. I'm not worthy of that. You can speak here, and my servant back 5 miles east of here, he's going to be well." Now, what's going on there? He's showing us who he is. And the first person to start to get it is who? It's the one who Jesus says has the most amazing faith. He says, "Listen, you're starting to put two and two together, and you're figuring out who I am, centurion, Roman outsider, not from a Jewish background. Person outside the church is looking at Jesus, putting it all together and figuring it out when those inside can't seem to figure it out. What's he putting together? Roman centurion. His knowledge of Judaism would have been cursory. He might have read the beginning of Genesis just to understand that, okay, they believe that there's just one God and that it's their God, that he created the universe. Oh, I see. I've read about this. He sees the ministry of Jesus, and he's read about the Jewish God who speaks and says, let there be light, and it's done. And he speaks and says, let there be. Again and again and again, 6 days in a row, he speaks and his words carry reality into existence. His words have the power to rewrite history, to recreate, to do anything. And this outsider with minimal knowledge of Judaism, but knows what he is seeing because he is seeing a man unlike any other man, doing things that no other man can do, teaching like no other man can teach, and he speaks. And the world changes. And he's perhaps the first person to begin to grasp that Jesus is that figure he had read about through whom the universe was made. Understanding who he is through this. And Jesus even tells the leper to go and show yourself to the priest as a testimony to them. This was supposed to show us who he is, and yet it was also pointing us to what is to come. To that shalom, to that ultimate healing of which this is just the first drop of water in an ocean that is going to wash over us. A world that's coming through each act, showing us that there will be a world that Jesus will establish someday when he returns, in which no one is excluded from a community like a leper, in which no one is ostracized or rejected, in which sickness and disease have been vanquished, and hate is no more. There is no more war, but people will beat their swords into plowshares, where spiritual forces that oppose and oppress us are vanquished. When Jesus feeds the poor, when he defends the oppressed, when he heals the sick, he's painting a picture of what's coming next. Restoring the world back to what it was meant to be. It's been said that miracles are not a suspension of the laws of nature. They are a restoration of the laws of nature back to what it was intended to be, back to what they will be again when the work of Christ is complete. You know the story from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the Chronicles of Narnia, in which the world is covered with snow, in which every tree is frozen, and in which it is doomed to always be winter, always winter, and yet never what? Never Christmas. For the White Witch rules, and Aslan is nowhere to be seen. The king is distant, and the false king reigns, a reign of terror over the people. And there is that point in which the children are walking along through the snow, leaving their big, deep footprints, small but deep, as it's been cold for so very long. And then one of the children begins to feel a drip of water on their head, and another one splashes. And then they come to a clearing, and there's a little bright patch of sunlight, and they look down, and they see something. What do they see? I think we've got a picture, Nick, if you can get that up. Yeah, we saw it there briefly. What they see is this little patch where the snow has melted away, and out of it is blooming a crocus. And at that point, they know that Aslan is on the move. At that point, they know that the White Witch's power is beginning to fade, that she will be vanquished. At that point, they know that winter is almost over, that Christmas is coming, and beyond it, the spring and the summer of life, as Aslan is once again restored to his throne and the White Witch is vanquished. This is what Jesus is doing with every one of these healings. You say, that's just one leper, that's just one mother-in-law, that's just one Roman centurion, that's just a handful of people who have been afflicted by spirits, and yet that's just two crocuses. And it spells doom for everything that oppresses us, because light and life have broken in. That is what Jesus is saying. Thank you, Nick. What does it cost? Who did Jesus heal? Losers. That's who he builds his church with. That's who he loves. That's who he calls. People who know that they're broken, diverse from every cross-section. That's who he heals. Why does he do it? To show who he is and to show what he's going to do when he returns and makes everything new. What cost? You know what it would cost you or me to do this. If we were thinking like humans think, you say, well, if we want a world with no more suffering, no more sickness, no more death, no more evil, if we want to make the world right, well, first of all, God, you're going to have to take out all of the murderers and all of the child abusers and get rid of them. And then the terrorists, Islamic State and Al-Nusra Front and Al-Qaeda, and then the drug pushers, because they're the people tempting us in our weakness. And God, then you're going to have to knock off all the arsonists who burn churches and stuff. And then you're going to have to get rid of gang members who have all their problems. And then the drug addicts. And then the alcoholics, they're just drinking themselves down. And then the people who have abandoned their marriages. And then, of course, you're going to have to get rid of the greedy people. And then the materialistic people. And then the bitter people. And then the people who have used their tongues to insult other people. And then you're going to have to get rid of all the men who have objectified women or men and looked at them lustfully. And then what's the problem? If the solution is to get rid of the sinners, then nobody's left. We're all toast. Jesus didn't come to do that. It says here in this reference at the end, he took up our infirmities and carried our diseases, quoting the longer prophecy of Isaiah 53, in this case, verse 4. He took up our infirmities and bore our diseases. Jesus didn't come into the world to bring judgment. He came to bear judgment. He came to absorb all that is broken, to absorb all that is damaged. What they expected when they saw Jesus reach out that man to that leper, they expected to see the filth and uncleanness and disease go and overtake Jesus as he absorbed it into himself, and ultimately on the cross, that is exactly what Jesus was going to do. Look at the cross. It's the crux of our faith. It's the center of our religion, that what it cost Jesus to heal, what it cost him from the time he stretched out his hand and healed that first leper, he was making a choice. He knew that he would have to pay for it, that he would have to carry that grief, that he would have to carry that sorrow, that he would have to take all of our unrighteousness and our transgression and our separation from God and absorb that into himself from the first moment he touched the leper. His fate was sealed. He had made his choice. Think back to the temptation of Jesus. Back in early chapters, the devil tempted Jesus. He said, throw yourself off the temple. Make yourself invulnerable. Make yourself into a superhero. Jesus is telling us here that he came to do just the opposite. He came not to become invincible, but to become vulnerable for our sake. To become crushable. To become beatable. To become diseased and despised, to take the separation between you and God into himself so that he would be separated from God, so that he would be rejected from God, so that you would never experience that. He came to bear our iniquities and to bear our suffering and to bear our shame. It's the word become flesh, absorbing it all into him. They don't just go away. He bears them. He takes them to the cross. He faces the wrath of God. He absorbs it. He drinks it all the way down to the dregs of the barrel. And then he rises in power as our hero and our victor. The immortal becomes mortal. That's what it costs Jesus. To gain our relationship with God, he had to lose his. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus weeps before the Father. He says, if there is any other way, let this cup be taken from me. And the Father speaks to Jesus and he says, you can have the leper and you can have the mother-in-law. And Jesus, my son, you can have those people who have been accursed by spirits. And you can have the Roman centurion, and you can have people from the east and from the west, and you can have the adulterers, and you can have the drug addicts, and you can have the bitter people, and you can have the critical spirits, and you can have all of those people. You can have Mary and Jane, Ahmad, and everybody. You can have them all, but it's going to cost you hell. And Jesus says, then give me hell, And that's what he did on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? Utterly rejected by God himself as well as men, so that you, friends, could be healed. How does Jesus convince a skeptical world? He doesn't do it by winning an argument. He doesn't do it by becoming strong. He doesn't do it by getting his guys into office. He does it by becoming vulnerable and weak and bearing our shame. The arms of Christ outstretched in love, nailed there to the cross. I heard a story.